And our connection for this hour is a tale of two farms. One, a large-scale duck farm that supplies fine dining restaurants in New York City. The other, a small game bird and poultry farm that has a farm stand and some CSAs. Which do you think is more likely to survive a global pandemic? It's not a plandemic, it's a pandemic. Which is more likely to survive it? Who's likely to suffer? The answer may not be what you think. A recent New York Times piece told the stories of these two farms, among others, as the coronavirus pandemic has disrupted food supply chains. To go back to the question of which farm is better set to survive the pandemic, the answer is the smaller farm. As reported by the Times, farms with single crops meant for use in large commercial operations are losing business as parts of the economy like restaurants shut down. With more people staying home and eating at home, the demand for a variety of products from local farms has spiked. Experts say we can learn a lot about the global food system as a result of the pandemic. From millions of pints of milk being dumped down drains in Britain to strawberries meant for markets in India being fed to cattle, the pandemic has exposed weaknesses in the international food trade. The global food system is built around countries specializing in specific products. Think cocoa in Ghana and potatoes in Belgium. But when borders close and demand drops, the system can go awry and people can end up hungry while some food rots. What's the solution here? Experts, many of them, point to this surprise boom experienced by small local farms and regional food hubs. They argue that an increase in diverse local food production creates more sustainable systems. So we're joined now by the team at Headwater Food Hub to discuss the work building a sustainable food system in Rochester and what it looks like during a pandemic and beyond. Our guests include the founder and president of Headwater Food Hub, Chris Hartman. Chris, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan. I appreciate it.
Stefan Schwartz is the director of Headwater at Home and value add merchant at Headwater Food Hub. Stefan, welcome back.
Thanks, Evan. Nice to be here.
And TC Washington is a farm to school program manager and emergency food assistance program manager at Headwater. TC, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Evan. Thanks so much for having us.
Chris, start with this. Just make sure our listeners know what Headwater is in sort of the short description.
Yeah, Headwater Foods is a project in the Rochester area going on its 11th year in operation, really trying to build out an alternative model food system based on social and environmental justice principles. And in the way, as your intro just described, we've been very focused on a sustainable food system that delivers a wide range of community impacts, including resilience and diversification and safety on a few different levels. And for us, as far as the nuts and bolts of our activities, we work with about 200 different farmers and food producers across New York State and the Northeast region, and we do a variety of things to aggregate that food at our warehouse, make it ready for the various customers that we service, and send it out into the community, both to individuals and families through our Headwater at Home program that Stefan's leading, as well as schools and universities as TC helps guide, and a variety of other wonderful customer partners like restaurants, retailers, butcher shops, and things like that. And basically, from a fundamental summary perspective, we're really trying to put together a values-based supply chain of food that dials back to social and environmental responsibility and the support of sustainable family farms across New York State.
So, Chris, this is, I think, an important moment to understand. If you think what's happening right now is a momentary phenomenon, or if this portends some real change here. And I ask that because it's different based on what you're talking about. If we're talking about education, as we did last week on this program, you know, for a while people were starting to talk about, well, maybe this, you know, telelearning is more efficient. Maybe we should do more of it. And by now, a lot of people are saying, no, let's get back to more kids in classrooms and less technology, more, you know, direct conversations with teachers, et cetera. Whereas with food, I am curious to know if you think what's happening now, could we sustainably move past the pandemic and operate similar to this going forward? What are the lessons here?
Yeah, I certainly believe we could. And in many ways, that is what we are advocating for. You know, it is interesting. This is a moment in which the community's attention towards our food system and our reliance on it and its stability, you know, there's a lot of spotlights on all of that. You know, it is quite likely that the possibility that the pandemic eventually dissipates and grocery stores become places we are all more comfortable to return to and all of the other things, that we could revert back to the ways things were. And, you know, again, I think it's from our standpoint, there's a lot of interest in what's available to us within these regional, you know, resilient food systems, and an important part of the communication and messaging and experience we want people to have as they participate right now is that beyond just the safe access to food during this pandemic, what's happening right now as far as the mass participation in these localized food systems is communities significantly investing in a food system that beyond just safe access to food outside of the grocery store, a food system that is delivering multiple layers of positive impact to our communities from both social and environmental and economic perspectives. And indeed, we have the opportunity to take what has been a sort of rapid, radical, forced change in our behavior and recognize that, at least this piece of it during the pandemic, recognize that as a positive thing that we've been forced to consider. And if we can, as a community, choose to further invest in it towards the future, I think the impacts accordingly are just endless as far as what we could create and the positive impact that has.
Before I turn to Stefan and TC to kind of jump in on that and kind of talk about some of the work they're doing, tell me in this future that we're envisioning, whether it's next year, 2 years, however long until we're sort of post-pandemic, Chris, the, you know, for example, the massive industrial scale operations with chickens that can barely stand up and are pumped full of antibiotics and millions upon millions of birds in the same place, these duck farms that the New York Times profiled vis-a-vis some smaller farms. What happens to them? And I'm not saying you're rooting for anybody to either go to business or whatever, but realistically, in this future, if we are operating in this different way, what happens to those bigger ones?
I think, you know, change is going to be required on a variety of layers of our existing industrial food system. And appropriate scale production facilities and systems, particularly in meat, you know, we are going to need to rethink where a majority of our proteins are coming from. And many farmers are. Again, that's an exciting aspect of what's happening now. There are existing alternatives, and there are great models for us to invest in. You know, as far as how farmers that are existing in the current industrial food system, how they're businesses and livelihoods and families are able to transition to that. You know, again, I think that's something that is a necessary systems level thought process, and not something we want to just leave individual farmers to suffer and or benefit from. You know, and farming in the ways that we've chosen since 1970 to invest in those larger, more efficient, huge scaled operations, and small farmers lost out in a lot of ways. We would certainly, if we had the opportunity to switch the pendulum, we would want to do it in a very, very responsible and more righteous way as far as a community deciding how do we share the risk associated with reconfiguring our food system in a way that respects farmers, respects the history and heritage and families involved in farming, and yet as a society, as a community, moves us forward in the direction we all want to go.
Stefan, I know you've led Headwaters transition from the Good Food Collective, which a lot of listeners will, of course, recognize, to Headwater at Home. So let's talk about what that is. What's Headwater at Home?
Headwater at Home is Headwater Foods' new direct-to-consumer model. And folks that know the Good Food Collective know it as a subscription-style service modeled on a CSA box. We are not a farm, so it's not a traditional CSA, but we've transitioned to more or less. I mean, so we had this plan originally, and what happened with COVID was, you know, we saw an immediate need to get good food to people in the community as well as support farmers that were scrambling with a rapidly changing marketplace. And so what we did is we opened up our wholesale catalog to consumers and launched it as Headwater at Home, which is basically almost an online farmers market where we have 200 farmers, you know, backing up to our online platform, and people are shopping exactly the quantities and the items that they want to buy. And then either through kind of multiple delivery systems, both home delivery and what we're calling our community distributions, folks are then showing up to pick up their food from these local growers. And just kind of one reason why we're excited about it is going back to this, you know, this question you posed to Chris about, you know, will this last? And when the pandemic dissipates, how is this all going to turn out? I think, you know, something that us at Headwater that we're really excited about is we feel like as a food hub with 11 years of experience developing these supply chains, delivery systems, and general know-how, is that we're creating a system that is really making sense for people. They can get exactly what they need. The price is right. The quality is there. The consistency is there. And so far, the response from the community has been overwhelmingly positive. So we're really excited about it.
Do you think, again, that the response that you're seeing is representative of something that is sustainable going forward? I mean, if we are, let's say, in the summer of 2021, we're post-vaccine, we're post-pandemic, do you expect to kind of retransition in a different direction with Headwater at Home or the Good Food Collective? I mean, what are your thoughts on the future direction there?
So the future direction, as we know, there are a lot of question marks, and as even Cuomo said, the world is full of surprises, which I think we've always known. But we'd really like to, and we plan to refine this model and continue to grow it and make it better and better for more and more people in our community. In my mind, the ability to shop and kind of purchase what you need for your family or individual needs is going to make sense for people moving forward. One thing that COVID has done is it's forced some people to change some of their purchasing habits. And we've really felt the responsibility and continue to feel the responsibility to when they turn away from the grocery stores or they need to find a kind of a new way to purchase their food, that we have a system that is making sense for them on a variety of levels, as well as making sense for the food systems that we're developing. But I do believe, the problems, climate change continues to be an issue, and will only, become greater as the years go on. And so, I think there's more and more need and urgency for these regional food systems. And I think COVID really has just sort of shown people some of the dangers of these highly centralized systems that we're currently depending on as a society.
So TC, as someone who is the Farm to School Program Manager and Emergency Food Assistance Program Manager, obviously, a lot of people are hurting right now. Families are hurting, and some are really, really hurting when it comes to just food availability. What's your team doing to help sustain people in need?
Sure. So when we opened up our wholesale catalog to individuals, the emails and the phone calls really started pouring in from customers asking about different ways that they could get involved in emergency food programs. Neighbors were really looking to support one another, and we were getting questions about everything from buying bulk flour to bake bread for their neighbors who couldn't leave their homes, or wanting to purchase food for first responders and frontline workers in their communities. And then just with our deep connections with schools and institutions, we were hearing from funders and from schools and youth programs about families who maybe participated in the school meals program, and those meals now were being required to be sourced and had at home. And so we really wanted to get involved in that, and we're set up pretty well to do so. We opened up a way for our customers to give through our online portal to a handful of causes that we're involved in, and the response there has also been overwhelming. We've raised almost $20,000 since we've opened up, and have sourced thousands of boxes of beautiful local produce to families whose K-12 students, would have been eating at school, and those have a good combination of proteins and produce and dairy that are all local, in addition to educational materials to keep students engaged while they're out of school, things like recipe cards or how do you pickle certain vegetables or, you know, what grows when. Let's talk about seasonality. So really incorporating the education piece into local food. We've also donated thousands of pounds to local food emergency programs, the food banks, and have worked with regional partners to find marketplaces for access produce and value-added products going into, you know, over 6,000 boxes to individuals across the state every week. So the response has really been swift, and it has been significant for people who really want to help and support their neighbors. These issues aren't new, but I think that the crisis is really shining a light on an issue of food security, and people want to get involved. And I think our partnerships just set us up really well to be a good resource for those people to make an impact and make sure that they could support their community.
Talking about food systems, the current situation that the New York Times has been reporting on, especially with smaller farms that offer more diverse produce and options thriving in some ways, while medium to larger size operations that focus on, say, a single thing have really been hurting, especially as they rely on the restaurant industry that is largely shut down right now. But here's a comment for Chris Hartman. Adam says, all of this sounds great, and it probably costs more. And if that is the case, expect things to go back to how they were as soon as this pandemic is over. People tend to want the cheapest options. That's why your grocery stores look the way they do, and I don't see that changing. That's from Adam. All right, Chris, want to take it?
Yes, and that's a great comment, a great question, and indeed one of the really important parts of this puzzle that we're all trying to solve in different ways. You know, the situation as far as what food is expensive and what food is cheap or inexpensive and why that is a pretty complicated subject when there's a lot of different levers and pieces that are influencing that. There's, in my opinion, and there's certainly a lot to support this, there's nothing inherently more expensive about healthy, cleaned, sustainable food produced on New York small to mid-sized farms. But you put that activity within the context of 100 years of ag policy on federal, state, and county levels that has prioritized large monocrop efficient systems. You put that in the context of the various corporate participation in the food system, the insurance programs overlying agriculture, a variety of variables that really, in a lot of ways, stack the deck against the small mid-sized producer. And in that way, this isn't. I don't want this to turn into the individual choice conundrum of people needing to choose to spend more to benefit the community food system that they want to participate in. It is about systems level change. It is about both policy and farm and market-based innovation that really can help to make sense of what are the real costs of the inexpensive food system that we're currently participating in environmentally and socially. How do we recognize that? How do we understand those? And how do we reprioritize the value of what has formerly been more expensive food options at the cash register ring and understand the cost savings associated with those investments? And again, that's a systems level wrestling of the problem, but it is true. I don't expect that this is going to work if we all simply are expected to spend a lot more on food and everything else stays
sure.
the same.
And
we really do need to understand the context of how that decision is unfolding.
So I want to ask all three of you about this in a follow-up, because to me this is a little bit like, at least there is kind of an analog to energy, when for years we heard some dissenters say, well, you know, you can't just you know, invest or subsidize clean energy because it's got to be able to compete on its own. And that always left me wondering, you don't think we're subsidizing big oil? You don't think we're subsidizing fossil fuels? Of course we are. But big oil, fossil fuel producers, they've been at the table and in the halls of power. And they are very good at not only getting the bills they want, but participating in the writing of those bills. And it is very hard to change that inertia. Similarly, when it comes to ag policy, Chris, you know, look, I'm not an expert in the weeds of this, but I take the point that we can't just get down, as Adam's email says, to saying, well, if it's going to be cheaper, we're just going to go back. Because there are different reasons that it's cheaper to do it certain ways, especially when there is federal subsidy, support, sort of government propping up of certain systems the way they are. And I'm not necessarily challenging that. I'm just asking you, how do you think you're going to change that? I mean, it's really hard to move a rock up the hill like that, Chris.
Yeah. No, it is, and we know that challenge well. And luckily, there's a lot of really passionate, smart people that are role models of ours that are also trying to push that heavy rock up the hill, as it were. But I think there's progress being made, and there is progress to be made. And you know, again, I think we've mentioned the kind of current attention that the pandemic has brought to this, but you know, other very urgent matters like climate change, like the humane treatment of animals, like social equity and food access, these are all really important, really urgent issues and very costly things that are associated with our food system. And there is increasing recognition and understanding on a variety of levels. And, you know, one of the things that I'm hopeful and excited about in this current level of participation is, you know, the other thing that the current industrial food system has, quote unquote, going for it is simply the scale and the efficiency that creates. You know, the more that we're able to participate in this sustainable regional food system, the more we're similarly able to create network optimization strategies and more collaborative structures that produce more volumes of food at still great prices or fair prices for farmers, but affordable options for people in supermarkets or farmers markets, et cetera. And, you know, New York State, one of the emergency food assistance programs that we've participated in, or a few of them are related to government, you know, funding associated with helping to feed people. And, you know, there too is a really interesting opportunity to further support the long-term work we want to do well after this pandemic as far as rebuilding resilient and responsible food systems. In New York, as a leading innovator state in its sort of ag economic development efforts, they're putting $25 million towards food assistance programs, but specifically tying it back to sourcing from New York State farmers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to me, that's a great example of, as is everybody's current shopping habits with Headwater Food, of here's a way in which we can begin to invest in significant ways as communities to start to drive the vibrancy, but also the economic viability and efficiency of these resilient regional food systems. And I you know, if you start to add in the environmental and social and just ethical costs associated with our food system, we're the best deal in town. There's no doubt about it.
Well, and so in our last 3 minutes, I want Stefan and TC to kind of jump in on that. Stefan, real briefly before we lose the hour, how do people learn more about Headwater at Home and find you?
So, and just really, really quickly on that point too, and it's one sentence, is like, you know, at Headwater, we do not only define good food by being local and organic. Affordability, accessibility, and scalability are really important to us as we think about how do we grow this thing and make this a viable option year round for people in our region. So there's that piece of it. In terms of learning more about us, headwaterfoodhub.com is our website, and our emails and contact information are on there, and sign up is there. But we are also fielding lots of questions with folks who want to learn more, and we are excited to have those conversations and walk people through the process.
And Stefan, maybe and the Let me just jump in and say maybe you can respond in about a minute's time to Yvonne. Yvonne says, I must respectfully disagree with the caller. Adam, I've been a member of Good Food Collective in Headwater for several years now. I recognize this is a privilege. However, I would much rather pay a little extra for the knowledge that my food is coming from a sustainable and likely organic source. I feel like I know my farmers and where my food is coming from. That's worth the world to me. So glad to hear these folks' voices on your show today. That's from Yvonne. Go ahead, Stefan.
Awesome. Well, and that's the other thing I wanted to say is, you know, I think we do need to be careful of you know, knowing that there's federal policy issues. We that should not be the burden of people in the community having to shoulder all of those costs just to be able to say they're doing the right thing. But what we are seeing, and we've seen for the past 10 years, is there are a lot of people in our community, and this number is growing, that are interested in where their food is coming from. They understand that, you know, the cheapest thing on the shelf, there's additional hidden costs to that are not being reflected in the price, and they are excited to pay a bit more for some of these products. Again, not all of our products are going to be more expensive than what you're going to find at the store, but you know, folks are taking this seriously. It's one of the best ways, you know, that we're used to this phrase of voting with your wallet, and our food purchases are really our most effective and immediate way to do that. And so we've got a lot of members who are, you know, big supporters and who we are just, you know, so thrilled to have on our side. And yeah, we just want to continue to grow this and make it accessible to more folks in the community.
All right. The last 50 seconds goes to TC Washington. Go ahead, TC.
Sure. Just to add to what my teammates are saying, too, you know, we're thinking not only about the individual purchasing, but the habits and how we develop habits of people to look for that good, healthy food, including, you know, the K-12 work we do. Students are now asking for local products for salad bars in their schools, and we're looking at really how we create responsible and thoughtful purchasers, and also how we get this local food to individuals, not just through their grocery bill, but also when they go out to eat or when they're eating at school or in the universities they attend. And so really thinking about just the marketplaces for our farmers, how we expand the opportunities that they have and how we really encourage this thoughtful purchasing, just the holistic picture of that.
Well, TC Washington, Stefan Schwartz, Chris Hartman, and the next conversation, Chris and team, maybe we should talk to some of the farmers you're working with and continue the conversation from their perspective. We would appreciate that. I think our listeners would. And I want to thank all three of you for making time for the program today.
Yeah, I really appreciate you having us on, Evan.
Wonderful. Chris Hartman, TC Washington, Stefan Schwartz from Headwater Food Hub, talking about what has been a kind of a quick transformation in food system during a global crisis. Short break. Coming up next hour, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand on Connections.